be evacuated. The entire American army would march off, except for 1,000 men left to hold Fort Washington. Officially, it was to be called an alteration of our position, not a retreat. The commander's orders for October 17th read in part as follows. As the movements of the enemy make an alteration of our position necessary, tents are to be struck and carefully rolled. The men to take the tent poles in their hands, 2 men out of a company, with a careful subaltern, to go with baggage and not leave it on any pretense. No packs, unless of sick men, chairs, tables, benches, or heavy lumber, are to be put on the wagons. No person, unless unable to walk, is to presume to get upon them. The wagons are to move forward before the regiments. Every regiment under marching orders to see they have their flints and ammunition in good order and complete. The exodus was soon underway, the army crossing the narrow bridge at Kingsbridge and heading north along the west bank of the Little Bronx River. The sick were the greatest burden. With teams and wagons in short supply, the trek was slow and difficult, the men themselves, in many cases, hauling the baggage wagons and cannon. Private Joseph Martin would remember lugging a cast-iron kettle the size of a milk pail until his arms were nearly dislocated. During a rest, he put it down, and as he wrote, one of the others gave it a shove with his foot, and it rolled down against a fence, and that was the last I ever saw of it. When we got through the night's march, we found our mess was not the only one that was rid of their iron bondage. As the first of Washington's armies struggled toward White Plains, the British made their swift landing at Pell's Point. Again, an advance force of 4,000 British and Hessian troops went ashore in the early morning, and this time were unopposed. They moved directly inland, a mile or more, and might have kept going had it not been for the intrepid John Glover and his men. The date was October 18th. From a hilltop before dawn, Glover had seen through a telescope what looked like upwards of 200 ships. Oh, the anxiety of mind I was in then for the fate of the day! I would have given 1,000 worlds to have had General Lee or some experienced officer present to direct or at least approve what I had done, Glover later wrote. Acting on his own, he rushed forward with some 750 men who fought tenaciously from behind stone walls, inflicting heavy casualties and stalling the enemy advance for a full day before forced to fall back. Colonel Loamy Baldwin, the Massachusetts apple grower who, with his small regiment, joined in the fight, later claimed the men stayed as calm as if shooting ducks. He thought the enemy dead numbered at least 200, which was undoubtedly an exaggeration. But even if he was wrong by half, the British lost more men killed at Pell's Point than in the Battle of Brooklyn. By Glover's calculations, American casualties numbered 8 dead, 13 wounded. Such ferocity as the Americans had shown appears to have stunned Howe, leading him to conclude that with stone walls lining every road and adjacent field, more deadly fire could be waiting at any turn. Had the British kept moving inland with speed, they might have caught Washington's retreating army head-on. As it was, the British advance along the shore as far as Mamaroneck, then inland toward White Plains, was slow and extremely cautious, seldom more than a few miles a day, and against little or no resistance. Probably Howe saw no more need to hurry now than he had before, and in fact he did not expect to cut the rebel retreat. Rather, in 18th-century military fashion, he hoped to maneuver Washington onto the open field, and then, with his superior professional force, destroy the Yankee rabble in one grand decisive victory. Even after reaching White Plains, Howe took another few days to be sure all was ready. At last, on October 28th, 10 days after landing at Pell's Point, William Howe sent 13,000 redcoats and Hessians up the main road to White Plains. It was early morning and yet another sparkling fall day. Washington, determined to avoid any test of strength on an open field, was well dug in on high ground in back of the village, his lines reaching more than a mile in length. For a brief time, it looked as though Howe intended to attack head-on, as the Americans hoped he would. British field guns opened fire, and Howe's army marched in perfect order in two columns, straight for where Washington commanded at the center. The sun shone bright, their arms glittered, and perhaps troops never were shown to more advantage than these now appeared, wrote General Heath of the oncoming foe. Suddenly, one column wheeled sharply left in the direction of a higher hill on the American right, on the other side of the Bronx River. Chatterton's Hill was thickly wooded on its slopes, but had open fields above, and it dominated the American lines. "Yonder is the ground we ought to occupy," Charles Lee had reportedly told Washington, but only at the last hour had troops been rushed to defend Chatterton's Hill, and these were mainly militia. The British artillery moved to closer range. Cannon roared on both sides. "The air and hills smoked and echoed terribly," wrote a Pennsylvania soldier. The fences and walls were knocked down and torn to pieces, and men's legs, arms, and bodies mingled with cannon and grapeshot all round us. Washington ordered more men to the top of Chatterton's Hill. The British and Hessians forded the river, and the Hessians, part of the newly arrived 7,000 led by Colonel Johann Rahl, launched the uphill charge. The militia broke and ran, and while the reinforcements, including Colonel Hazlitt's Delaware troops and Smallwood's Marylanders, fought bravely, they had to give way at the last. The Battle of White Plains was the Battle of Chatterton's Hill, and the British and the Hessians carried the day. But it was at a cost of more than 250 casualties, twice what the Americans suffered. Nor was it a victory that achieved anything. The day after, October 29th, Howe decided to pause again, to wait for still more reinforcements. The day after that, October 30th, it poured rain. On the morning of November 1st, Howe found that overnight Washington and his army had pulled back half a mile to a stronger position on high ground across the Bronx River. For two more days, the two armies waited and watched. "The enemy are determined on something decisive," Henry Knox wrote to his brother, "and we are determined to risk a general battle on the most advantageous terms." When on the night of November 3rd, American sentinels reported the rumbling of enemy carriages in the dark, it was assumed another attack was imminent. There was more stirring among the British ranks the next day, and the Americans braced themselves. But on the morning of November 5th, to the complete surprise of the Americans, the whole of the British army was in motion, heading off in another direction, southwest, toward the Hudson and King's Bridge. "Opinions here are various," Joseph Reed confided to his wife following a council of war during which he had kept the minutes. Some of the generals thought the British were headed for Fort Washington, or were bound for the Hudson to board ships and proceed upriver to attack from the rear. Others, in the great majority, think that finding this army too strongly posted, they have changed their whole plan, intending to penetrate the Jerseys and so move on to Philadelphia. Who said what or the most in the course of the meeting, Reed did not mention. In his own opinion, however, it was too late in the season for any British movements of consequence, other than a few excursions into New Jersey, perhaps, to revive the drooping spirits of the many Loyalists there. Washington doubted that Howe would close the campaign without attempting something more, as he wrote to John Hancock. Almost certainly Howe was headed for New Jersey. Near the close of the letter, Washington added a further worry. "I expect the enemy will bend their force against Fort Washington and invest it immediately," he said. The term invest meaning to surround and lay siege, not necessarily to attack all out. Like most of the army he led, Washington was still exhausted and dispirited. To some who were closest at hand, he seemed a little bewildered and unsuitably indecisive. Reed in particular, as he would later reveal, was having second thoughts about Washington's capacity for leadership. Increasingly worried over Fort Washington, the commander pondered whether to pull the troops out while there was yet time. In a letter to Nathaniel Greene from White Plains, dated November 8th, Washington had reasoned, as he might well have earlier, "If we cannot prevent vessels passing up the Hudson, and the enemy are possessed of the surrounding country, what valuable purpose can it answer to attempt to hold a post from which the expected benefit cannot be had? I am therefore inclined to think it will not be prudent to hazard the men and stores." Yet he left the decision to Greene. "But as you are on the spot, I leave it to you to give such orders as to evacuating, as you judge best." Central to all that had to be taken into consideration was the Hudson River, which loomed as large in everyone's calculations as it had for nearly a year, from the time Washington first dispatched Charles Lee south from Cambridge to take charge of fortifying New York. The Hudson, key to the whole British strategy. Would the British decide to take care of the unfinished business at Fort Washington on this side of the river, or would they cross over and strike into New Jersey, or might they do both? And what, in any case, should be done? Howe and his army were known to have reached Dobbs Ferry on the Hudson, less than 10 miles above King's Bridge, and were now moving south. Once again, Washington decided to divide his army, and this time four ways. 7,000 troops, much the largest part of the army, were to remain east of the Hudson under General Lee, to check any British move on New England. General Heath and another 3,000 were to guard the Hudson Highlands at Peekskill, New York, 30 miles to the north. Washington, with what was left of the army, only 2,000 men or so, would cross to the other side of the river, where it was expected he would be joined by New Jersey and Pennsylvania reinforcements. Nathaniel Greene was to maintain his same position on the river, with overall command of the troops at Fort Washington and Fort Lee. Washington and his 2,000 left White Plains on November 10th. At mid-morning, November 12th at Peekskill, he crossed the Hudson and headed directly south for New Jersey, reaching Fort Lee on November 13th. All told, a 65-mile march in 3 days. For the better part of 2 days, he and Greene conferred. Greene, who had yet to fight a battle, remained optimistic, convinced that Fort Washington could be held, and especially as he had more than doubled the number of troops at the fort, bringing the total force there to more than 2,000. It was a remarkable reversal of roles. Washington, who in September had refused to abandon New York, seemed ready now to do so. Greene, in September, had seen no reason to remain a day longer on York Island, and had he had his way, the whole present crisis would have been avoided. Yet it was Greene now who wanted to make a stand on the last bit of the island still in American hands, arguing that it would keep communications open across the river, tie up British troops that might otherwise join in an attack on New Jersey and ultimately Philadelphia, and lead possibly to another slaughter of the enemy as at Bunker Hill. Further, Greene reasoned, one more retreat could be devastating to the army's already demoralized state. Despite its formidable presence high over the river, its steep, rock-bound approaches, Fort Washington was in several ways not the impregnable bastion it seemed. An irregular pentagon in plan, it covered about 4 acres, its walls made of piled-up earth. There were no barracks for the troops, and there was no water supply, other than what could be hauled up from below, hardly what was needed in the event of a long siege with winter approaching. Nonetheless, its commander, Colonel Robert McGaw, thought the fort could hold out until the end of December, and Greene agreed. In his letter to Greene from White Plains, Washington had said he was inclined to think it prudent to abandon the fort, but left the decision to Greene, who was on the spot. Now that he himself was on the spot, Washington still could not decide what to do, and so again, in effect, he let the decision be Greene's. "His Excellency General Washington has been with me for several days, but finally nothing concluded on," Greene wrote to Henry Knox. "The movements and designs of the enemy are not yet understood," Washington reported to John Hancock. To the British captain Frederick Mackenzie, it was all but perfect campaigning weather. There had been a frost nearly every night, but it disappeared once the sun was up. The only thing lacking was a stiff breeze to accommodate the Navy. No wind for some days past, he recorded in his diary. So if it was intended to send any more ships up the North River, it could not have been affected. The entry, dated November 7th, affirmed that General Howe had by then established headquarters just 6 miles above King's Bridge, and that the next move would probably be against Fort Washington. But then Captain Mackenzie never doubted that reduction of the fort was the first object, and like others, he felt more confident than ever of success, for a fund of timely and accurate intelligence had unexpectedly fallen into British hands. If Washington failed still to understand British designs, the British now knew quite a lot about the American situation, or at least a great deal more than they might have. On November 2nd, when Howe's army was still at White Plains, an American staff officer named William Demont, whom Mackenzie referred to as William Diamond, turned traitor, defecting to the British from Fort Washington and bringing with him copies he had made of plans of the fort and the placement of cannon, as well as accounts of the mounting discontent and animosity between the rebels from New England and those from the South. Only days before, a packet of letters written by Washington, Reed, and others of Washington's staff wound up in British hands after being left unguarded at an inn at Trenton by a careless post rider bound for Philadelphia. In one letter, Washington complained bitterly of the lack of discipline in the army and wrote with scorn of the dreaming, sleepy-headed officers he had to contend with. Another letter, written by Lieutenant Colonel Robert Hanson Harrison of Washington's staff, provided the far more important revelation that Washington was dividing his army. The purloined letters and the plan of Fort Washington provided by Demont's treachery may not have greatly altered the course of events to follow, but the British rightfully considered them a windfall, as both Mackenzie's diary and that kept by Ambrose Searle attest. Washington's decision to divide the army was taken as a clearest possible sign of weakness. It is easy to see whither all this tends, and what will be the probable consequence of such a division, wrote Searle, who, as Lord Howe's secretary, had been the first to see the letters. If the rebels could not find spirit to act under the encouragement of their present numbers, there is little reason to believe that their courage will increase upon a reduction of their strength. The letters, thought Mackenzie, were certain to be of much service to General Howe. The British by this time had doubtless picked up sufficient information from deserters to know a considerable amount about the state of things at Fort Washington, but having the plans and Demont's account were of importance all the same, if only as confirmation. Be that as it may, the famously cautious William Howe, who supposedly would never risk a frontal attack on a heavily fortified rebel position because of the painful lesson learned at Bunker Hill, was about to disprove that theory, and with the full agreement of his commanders. Frederick Mackenzie had total confidence in the attack, predicting further, from the general appearance of matters, that as soon as Fort Washington was taken, Howe would move on to New Jersey. The fact that the rebel troops from New Jersey and Pennsylvania that Washington counted on for help had never materialized was also well known to the British, and this, thought Mackenzie, left little to prevent our arrival at Philadelphia. By November 12th, the day Washington crossed the Hudson, Howe's army was within 4 miles of King's Bridge. The plan was for a four-part assault, with the Hessians playing the major role. The plan began to unfold at midday November 15th, when Howe sent Colonel James Patterson under a white flag to deliver a message to the American commander at Fort Washington, Colonel McGaw. Patterson was the same British officer who in July had carried letters to Washington from Lord Howe proffering the possibility of peace. This time, he bore an ultimatum: surrender the fort or face annihilation. Told he had 2 hours to make up his mind, McGaw responded at once with a written reply. "Sir, if I rightly understand the purport of your message, This post is to be immediately surrendered or the garrison put to the sword. I rather think it is a mistake than a settled resolution in General Howe to act a part so unworthy of himself and the British nation, but give me leave to assure His Excellency that, actuated by the most glorious cause that mankind ever fought in, I am determined to defend this post to the very last extremity." Howe had no intention of carrying out his threat of slaughter. The ultimatum was designed to play on the fears and distress of the rebels. McGaw's bold response was written in the belief that he and his men could indeed hold out, or, if need be, escape across the Hudson after dark. When word of the ultimatum and of McGaw's answer reached Fort Lee later that afternoon, Nathaniel Greene dispatched a rider to tell Washington, who earlier had ridden to Hackensack, 6 miles away, where his army had pitched camp. Washington dashed back, arriving at Fort Lee at nightfall. Finding that Greene and Israel Putnam had been rowed across the river to meet with McGaw and appraise the situation, Washington followed in a small boat. Halfway across, he met Greene and Putnam, who were on their way back, and there, at mid-river in the dark, Greene and Putnam gave an encouraging report. The troops were in high spirits and would make a good defense. And thus, it being late at night, in Washington's words, the three returned to Fort Lee. The same night, as went unobserved by the Americans, the British brought a fleet of 30 flatboats up the river, with oars muffled, past Fort Washington, into Spuytendyvil Creek, and down the Harlem to be ready for morning. At first chance, early Saturday, November 16th, Washington, with Greene, Putnam, and another of his generals, Hugh Mercer of Virginia, again crossed the Hudson to determine, as Greene wrote, what was best to be done. No sooner had their boat pushed off than the sound of heavy cannon carried over the water, and off in the distance, to the left of Fort Washington, they could see the attack had begun. Landing on the opposite shore downriver from the fort, the four generals scrambled up the steep slopes to the crest, to a point near the Morris House. "There we all stood in a very awkward situation," wrote Greene. "As the disposition of the troops was made, and the enemy advancing, we durst not attempt to make any new disposition. Somehow, they still could not see the disaster in store. Indeed, we saw nothing amiss," Greene wrote. Concerned for Washington's safety, the three generals urged him to leave and go back over the river. Greene volunteered to stay, as in turn did Putnam and Mercer, but Washington thought it best that they all go. The assault came from three directions after a prolonged pounding of the fort's outer defenses by British cannon. 4,000 Hessians came down from the north, over the bridge at King's Bridge, led by General von Knyphausen, who had requested the honor of leading the main attack. The Hessians were professionals hired to perform a duty, and this was to be their day to show themselves superior in a profession they took extreme pride in. During the time he had been held prisoner, Lord Stirling had heard Hessian officers remark that they had never considered it their duty to inquire which of the two sides in the American controversy was right. A force of British troops under Cornwallis, plus a battalion of Highlanders, struck from the east, crossing the Harlem River in the flatboats that had been brought up during the night. The third force of some 3,000 men, both British and Hessians, came up from the south, led by Lord Percy. By 10 o'clock, Howe had committed 8,000 troops to the assault, nearly four times the number of those defending Fort Washington. The farthest reach of the fort's outer defenses was about 5 miles, north and south, and Knyphausen's Hessians faced the steepest, roughest terrain, and withering fire from Virginia and Maryland riflemen positioned among the rocks under Colonel Moses Rawlings. It was the scene of the most ferocious fighting of the day, and the Hessians were dauntless. The rock slopes they scaled would have been a rough struggle even had no one been firing at them. One of their officers, Captain Andreas Wiederhold, would describe attacking up this almost inaccessible rock, and yet every obstacle was swept aside, the precipitous rocks scaled. A Hessian soldier, John Reuber, wrote in his journal, "We were obliged to drag ourselves by the beech tree bushes, up the height where we could not really stand." At last, however, we got about on top of the hill where there were trees and great stones. We had a hard time of it there together. Because they had no idea of yielding, Colonel Rawl gave the word of command thus: "All that are my grenadiers, march forwards." All the drummers struck up the march. The hautboy players, oboe players, blew. At once all that were yet alive shouted, "Hurrah!" Immediately all were mingled together, Americans and Hessians. There was no more firing, but all ran forward, pell-mell, upon the fortress. General Grant, who disliked Hessians almost as much as he disliked Americans, wrote with unalloyed admiration of how they surmounted every difficulty, and after gaining the heights, kept on at a trot. And if General Knyphausen had not stopped Colonel Rawl, I am convinced he would have been in the fort in 5 minutes. The other sides of the attack advanced accordingly, with some of the American defenders putting up little resistance, while others fought tenaciously. Alexander Graydon, who commanded a company facing the assault by Lord Percy from the south, described how 150 men with a single 18-pound cannon held off 800 of the British. When Percy's attacking troops captured the Morris House, it was, according to Graydon, only 15 minutes after Washington and his generals made their exit. But courage was not enough. The Americans were too few to hold such extended lines. The only recourse was to retreat to the fort with all speed. A 17-year-old private from York, Pennsylvania, John Adlam, described running such a distance uphill that he had hardly breath enough to keep going. "As I was a good deal fatigued, and the firing had in great measure ceased, I walked to the fort very leisurely," he wrote. "Before I was near the fort, the British began to fire at it with a field piece with round shot, at the men who were standing in huddles between the fort and the lines, within the abattis that was round the fort. When I arrived at this work, I sat upon it looking at the enemy who were firing at us with the field piece, and not more than 400 yards of us, or from where I was then sitting, when at length a ball took off part of two men's heads and wounded another. I then went into the fort." By 1 o'clock, nearly all the defending force had been driven inside the fort, where there was scarcely any room for them. An hour or so later, the Hessian commander, Knyphausen, demanded surrender. Colonel McGaw said he needed time to decide and asked for half an hour. General Howe arrived and ordered the Americans to surrender immediately, and with no terms other than a promise of their lives. It was 3 o'clock when McGaw capitulated, and about 4 when the entire garrison, 2,837 Americans, marched out of the fort between two lines of Hessians and lay down their arms. In a disastrous campaign for New York in which Washington's army had suffered one humiliating, costly reverse after another, this, the surrender of Fort Washington on Saturday, November 16th, was the most devastating blow of all, an utter catastrophe. The taking of more than 1,000 American prisoners by the British at Brooklyn had been a dreadful loss. Now more than twice that number were marched off as prisoners, making a total loss from the two battles of nearly 4,000 men, from an army already rapidly disintegrating from sickness and desertions and in desperate need of almost anyone fit enough to pick up a musket. As Frederick McKenzie recorded, the British were astonished to find how many of the American prisoners were less than 15, or old men, all indifferently clothed, filthy and without shoes. Their odd figures frequently excited the laughter of our soldiers. The crushing defeat at Fort Washington, the capture of its garrison, plus quantities of arms, tools, tents, blankets, and some 146 brass and iron cannon, had been accomplished by the British and Hessians in a matter of hours, and it need never have happened. 59 Americans had been killed and 100 or more wounded. The British had lost 28 killed and over 100 wounded. Hessian losses were heavier, 58 killed and more than 250 wounded. Bad as it was, it could have been even worse. In the view of both General Grant and Colonel Mackenzie, an all-out slaughter of Americans had been avoided only because General Knyphausen stopped Colonel Rall and his Hessians from entering the fort. They had been pretty well pelted in the battle and were angry and would not have spared the Yankees, Grant wrote. The carnage then would have been dreadful, wrote Mackenzie, for the rebels were so numerous they had not room to defend themselves with effect, and so frightened they had not the power. What lay ahead of the Americans taken prisoner was a horror of another kind. Nearly all would be held captive in overcrowded, unheated barns and sheds, and on British prison ships in the harbor, where hundreds died of disease. Washington is said to have wept as he watched the tragedy unfold from across the river, and though this seems unlikely given his well-documented imperturbability, he surely wept within his soul. He had faced ruin before, but never like this. To his brother Jack he would write, "I am wearied almost to death with the retrograde motions of things." Nathaniel Greene, in an anguished letter to Henry Knox, said, "I feel mad, vexed, sick, and sorry. Never did I need the consoling voice of a friend more than now. Happy should I be to see you. This is a most terrible event. Its consequences are justly to be dreaded." Both Washington and Greene had been badly mistaken in their judgment, both worried over what would become of their reputations. Indeed, it would be hard to say which of them was the most sensitive to what others thought of them, and criticism of both was to be severe, and especially among those who had been taken prisoner. Alexander Graydon, writing more than a generation later, could still barely contain his disdain for the decisions that had been made. Most immediate and blistering was the reaction of Charles Lee. By his own account, Lee became so furious over the news of Fort Washington, he tore out some of his hair. "I must entreat that you will keep what I say to yourself, but I foresaw, predicted, all that has happened," Lee wrote to Dr. Benjamin Rush, an influential member of Congress, who, Lee knew, would never keep it to himself. Lee claimed his last words to Washington were, "Draw off the garrison or they will be lost." "Had I the powers, I could do you much good," he told Rush, not very subtly. "But I'm sure you will never give any man the necessary power." "Oh, General," Lee admonished Washington in a letter, "why would you be over-persuaded by men of inferior judgment to your own?" thereby inviting the commander to blame it all on Nathaniel Greene. Washington had failed to override Greene's judgment and make a clear decision of his own, and as commander-in-chief he was, of course, ultimately responsible. Greene's responsibility for what happened ceased with Washington's arrival at Fort Lee on November 13th, 3 days before the attack. Washington never blamed himself for the loss of Fort Washington, but then he never openly blamed Greene either, which he could have. He said only that he had acted on the judgment of others. Nor, importantly, did he fire Greene or shuffle him off to some meaningless, out-of-the-way command. He undoubtedly thought less of the young general than he had before. Still, he knew Greene's strengths. Only weeks before, Greene had demonstrated both rare foresight and a marked gift for organization when he recommended to Washington, and Washington agreed, that a series of supply depots be established across New Jersey, along what might, of necessity, become the Army's path of retreat, should the British make a drive toward Philadelphia. Washington needed Greene. He knew that Greene, like Knox, would never give up, never walk away, any more than he would, or lose sight of what the war was about, any more than he would. Washington would repay loyalty with loyalty, and this, after so many bad decisions, was one of his wisest decisions ever. Only one American hero was to emerge from what happened at Fort Washington. She was Margaret Molly Corbin, the wife of a Pennsylvania soldier, John Corbin, who had gone into battle at her husband's side, and when he was killed, stepped into his place to load and fire a cannon until she fell wounded, nearly losing one arm. After the surrender, she was allowed by her captors to return home to Pennsylvania. The usually unhurried William Howe made his next move with hardly a pause. 3 nights later, he sent 4,000 British and Hessian troops, under the cover of darkness and drenching rain, across the Hudson to land upstream from Fort Lee at a point called Closter. There, led by Cornwallis, they scaled the palisades, climbing a steep, almost perpendicular footpath, and once on top, advanced on Fort Lee. It was a daring attack, very like the one Howe himself, as a young officer, had led up the steep slopes of Quebec early on the morning of the British triumph there in the French and Indian War. Warning of the attack reached Fort Lee in advance, possibly from a local farmer, possibly from a British deserter. Accounts differ. Washington rushed to the scene from Hackensack and shouted orders to abandon the fort at once. Everything was to be left behind: guns, stores, hundreds of tents, even breakfast cooking on the fire. When the British arrived, they found the place deserted, but for a dozen men who had gotten into the rum supply and were all drunk. Washington and his army fled in haste down the road and over the Hackensack River, farther into New Jersey. Chapter 7. Darkest Hour. I hope this is the dark part of the night, which is generally just before day. General Nathaniel Greene. The retreat of George Washington and his battered little army southward across New Jersey began the morning of November 21st. They were headed for a crossing point called Aquakanonk on the Passaic River, 5 miles away, retreat being their only choice and rivers offering the one possible defense against the oncoming foe in dead flat country, as Washington described it, with no stone walls. Once over the Passaic, they pushed on another 20 miles down the west bank of the river to the little port town of Newark. Heavy rains had left the narrow road sloppy with mud, and the men were in tatters, many without shoes, their feet wrapped in rags. Washington rode at the rear of the column, a point long remembered by a newly arrived 18-year-old Virginia lieutenant named James Monroe. I saw him at the head of a small band, or rather in its rear, for he was always near the enemy, and his countenance and manner made an impression on me which I can never efface. By young Monroe's estimate, Washington had at most 3,000 men, yet his expression gave no sign of worry. A deportment so firm, so dignified, but yet so modest and composed, I have never seen in any other person. Washington had set the army on the road in the early morning, but not before getting off an urgent request to General Lee at North Castle, New York, in which he made his worries and troubles abundantly clear. The men were broken and dispirited. They had no tents, no baggage, no entrenching tools. Every pick and shovel had been left behind at Fort Lee. As things were, he dared not risk contact with the enemy, Washington wrote, and so must leave a very fine country open to their ravages. He urged Lee to cross the Hudson with his brigades and join forces before it was too late. New Jersey was too rich a prize to give up without even the appearance of a fight. Were New Jersey to fall, it could have devastating effect on Pennsylvania. To be certain Lee understood what he wanted, Washington said it again. I would have you move over by the easiest and best, swiftest passage. Yet it was a request only, not an order. The letter had been dictated to Joseph Reed and sent off by express rider in a dispatch case, into which Reed put a letter of his own to Lee. But of this Washington was told nothing. Reed's letter was a stunning indictment of Washington. At best, it could be taken as a desperate indiscretion. At worst, an underhanded act of betrayal. His commander's indecision over whether to abandon New York and again at Fort Washington had left Reed badly shaken. His confidence in Washington was shattered, but instead of confiding his feelings to Washington, he secretly poured them out to Lee, leaving no doubt as to who he thought should be leading the army in its hour of need. He wished most earnestly to have Lee where the principal scene of action is laid, Reed wrote, seconding what Washington had said. Then, claiming he had no wish to flatter Lee, he went on to do just that, and to make his main point. "I do not mean to flatter or praise you at the expense of any other, but I confess I do think it is entirely owing to you that this army and the liberties of America, so far as they are dependent on it, are not totally cut off. You have decision, a quality often wanted in minds otherwise valuable. Oh, General, an indecisive mind is one of the greatest misfortunes that can befall an army. How often have I lamented it, this campaign? All circumstances considered, we are in a very awful and alarming situation, one that requires the utmost wisdom and firmness of mind. As soon as the season will admit, I think yourself and some others should go to Congress and form the plan of the new army." Washington worried about the health of his men. He worried about rumors of a British invasion to the south of Newark at Perth Amboy, at the mouth of the Raritan River, where New Jersey and Staten Island were separated by only a narrow channel. In less than 2 weeks, on December 1st, the enlistments of 2,000 of his troops would be up, the men free to go. It was the same nightmare prospect he had faced at Boston exactly a year before, and with the misery of the men greater now than ever, and morale suffering, there seemed to be every chance that his army would evaporate before his eyes. Privately, Washington talked with Reed about the possibility of retreating to western Pennsylvania if necessary. Reed thought if eastern Pennsylvania were to give up, the rest of the state would follow. Washington is said to have passed his hand over his throat and remarked, "My neck does not feel as though it was made for a halter." He talked of retreating to the mountains of Augusta County in western Virginia. From there they could carry on a predatory war, Washington said, and if overpowered, we must cross the Allegheny Mountains. He knew, as the enemy had little idea, just how big a country it was. The problem was not that there were too few American soldiers in the 13 states. There were plenty, but the states were reluctant to send the troops they had to help fight the war, preferring to keep them close to home, and especially as the war was not going well. In August, Washington had had an army of 20,000. In 3 months since, he had lost four battles, at Brooklyn, Kips Bay, White Plains, and Fort Washington, then gave up Fort Lee without a fight. His army now was divided, as it had not been in August, and just as young Lieutenant Monroe had speculated, he had only about 3,500 troops under his personal command. That was all. Desperate for help, he sent Reed off to Burlington, New Jersey, on the eastern bank of the Delaware River, upstream from Philadelphia, to impress upon the governor of New Jersey, William Livingston, the urgent need for reinforcements. As it was, New Jersey militia were not turning out in any numbers that could make a difference. General Mifflin was dispatched on a similar mission to Philadelphia to alert Congress to the critical state of our affairs and do everything possible to round up Pennsylvania troops and send them on with all speed. These were two critical undertakings, and in the choice of Reed, his closest confidant, and the very able Mifflin, the Philadelphian who had shown such valor in command of the rear guard at Brooklyn, Washington felt confident he was sending two of the best men he had, and that this would not be lost on any who listened to what they had to say. The first report from Mifflin was bitterly disappointing. His fellow Pennsylvanians were divided and lethargic, Mifflin wrote, slumbering under the shade of peace and in the full enjoyment of the sweets of commerce. From Reed, Washington heard nothing. It rained heavily on November 22nd, the day the army reached Newark, and rain fell through that night and again the next day. "The sufferings we endured are beyond description. No tent to cover us at night, exposed to cold and rains day and night," one soldier would remember. Colonel Samuel Webb, writing at the time, said it was impossible to describe conditions as they were. "I can only say that no lads ever showed greater activity in retreating than we have. Our soldiers are the best fellows in the world at this business. Webb, who had only just recovered from wounds received at White Plains, served still on Washington's staff. But of greatest importance, as time would tell, was the impression made on Thomas Paine, the author of Common Sense, who had recently volunteered to serve as a civilian aide on Greene's staff. Greene, with his love of literature and political philosophy, had taken a great liking to the brilliant Paine, an impoverished English immigrant who, like Greene, had been raised a Quaker, and whose pamphlet Common Sense, since its appearance early in the year, had become more widely read than anything yet published in America. Greene called him Common Sense. Common Sense and Colonel Snarl, or Cornell, are perpetually wrangling about mathematical problems, Greene had reported to his wife during less troubled times before the fall of Fort Washington. Sick at heart over the suffering and despair he saw, but inspired by the undaunted resolution of many around him, Paine is said to have committed his thoughts to paper during the retreat, writing at night on a drumhead by the light of a campfire. He himself, however, said it was not until later at Philadelphia that in a passion of patriotism he began what he called the crisis, with its immortal opening lines. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will in this crisis shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. On November 24th, Washington sent off another message to General Lee, saying he must come by a safe and secure route and asking that he bring a particular 24-pound cannon, provided it can be done without great inconvenience. With Loyalists more prevalent in New Jersey than in any other of the 13 states, and American deserters continuing to go over to the enemy, Washington's plight was well known to the British command. The fact is, wrote Lord Rawdon, their army is broken all to pieces, and the spirit of their leaders and their abettors is all broken. I think one may venture to pronounce that it is well nigh over with them. Since the fall of Fort Washington, there had been a major shift in British plans. General Clinton was reassigned. He was to sail with an expedition of 6,000 troops to take Rhode Island, or more specifically Newport. For in the time when the fortunes of the rebel army were going steadily from bad to worse, rebel privateers off the New England coast had been attacking British supply ships with increasing success, and Admiral Lord Howe was in need of a secure, ice-free winter roadstead in the vicinity for some of his fleet. Clinton thought ill of the Rhode Island expedition. He had argued that it would be postponed, and that instead he and his forces land at Perth Amboy, and thus outflank and destroy the crippled rebels in one sweeping, concentrated effort before the onset of winter snow. Or, Clinton proposed, he could carry his attack directly to Philadelphia by sailing up the Delaware. This, in all probability, he later wrote, would have dispersed the Congress and deranged all their affairs. It was a critical moment in the management of the war, with Clinton and William Howe once more opposed on how best to proceed. Clinton continued to see Washington's army as the heart of the rebellion, and the envelopment of the army, therefore, as the most expeditious strategy. Howe wanted to keep the Americans on the run and continued to clear the board, so to speak, to clear New Jersey and Rhode Island of the rebel forces just as he had cleared New York. And by such conquests of vital territory bring the deluded American people and their political leaders to their senses and end their demonstrably futile rebellion. Clinton was overruled, and though unconvinced, he departed dutifully for Rhode Island, where his expedition seized Newport without opposition, and the predominantly Quaker inhabitants seemed quite happy to live in peace under his protection. But it was a conquest of little importance. As would be said, its effect on the course of the war was about what it would have been had Clinton's forces occupied the town of Newport on the Isle of Wight. Difficulties between Clinton and William Howe, the friction of the two contrasting personalities, had grown steadily worse. At White Plains, in an outburst of frustration and anger, Clinton had told General Cornwallis he could not bear to serve under Howe, and this Cornwallis had chosen to tell Howe. Thus it was with considerable relief that Howe saw Clinton sail off from New York, just as when Clinton had departed Boston for South Carolina. In Clinton's place, Howe put Cornwallis, knowing he had a far more reasonable man to deal with and a highly energetic and effective field commander. Like Howe, indeed like Clinton, Charles Cornwallis was a true 18th-century English aristocrat, a shining representative of Britain's ruling class, born to wealth, position, and influence. Schooled at Eton, he had decided in his youth on a military career, in which he had distinguished himself ever since. At age 37, he was at his professional prime, but unlike Howe, a man with no bad habits or inclinations to self-indulgence. And if not as intellectually gifted as Clinton, he had no peevish or contrary side. Tall and somewhat overweight, as was the fashion, he carried himself well and was considered handsome, except for a cast in one eye. In fact, he had lost sight in one eye as a result of a boyhood accident. He was devoted to his ailing wife, whom he missed dreadfully, and devoted to his men. "I love that army," he once declared, and their devotion to him was notable. He was the most popular British general serving in America, known to be strict but fair, and genuinely concerned for the well-being of his troops. Repeatedly in the year's campaign, at Brooklyn, Kipps Bay, Fort Washington, and in his stunning surprise capture of Fort Lee, he had shown himself to be enterprising and aggressive. Thus far, he had done everything right. On November 23rd, 2 days after the capture of Fort Lee, Cornwallis had met there with General Howe, who, having been made a Knight of the Bath by the King, was now Sir William Howe. The two conferred for several hours, going over the map of New Jersey and reviewing plans. Howe gave orders to Cornwallis to pursue the rebels as far as New Brunswick, or Brunswick as it was then known, another 50 miles south of Newark on the Raritan River, and stop there until further orders. On November 25th, after the rains subsided, Cornwallis and an army now numbering 10,000 set off, determined to catch Washington, Cornwallis said, as a hunter bags a fox. But on the rain-drenched roads, in muck ankle-deep or worse, the long columns of redcoats and Hessians, with their heavy baggage trains and artillery, moved slower even than the Americans had. They were 3 days reaching Newark. At 9 o'clock on the morning of November 28th, the British engineering officer, Captain Archibald Robertson, recorded, "All the army marched in two columns towards Newark, where it was said the rebels would stand. About 1 o'clock, the British advanced on the town in force, only to find it empty. Washington had pressed on toward Brunswick and the Raritan. The enemy gave us not the least interruption upon our march," he wrote to General Heath. There was word at last from Charles Lee, but only to report his own tribulations with foul weather and men without shoes. He was still at North Castle and made no mention of plans to leave. Washington replied at once, "My former letters were so full and explicit as to the necessity of your marching as early as possible that I confess I expected you would have been sooner in motion," he said sharply. Yet he was still reluctant to issue a clear order to Lee. By the time he reached Brunswick the morning of November 29th, Washington had been joined by the dauntless Lord Stirling and more than 1,000 reinforcements. They were a first glimmer of hope, though hardly enough. Numbers of Stirling's men, too, were shoeless and without coats or even shirts, and the December 1st expiration of enlistments, when twice that number would be free to leave, was only 2 days away. On November 30th at Brunswick, a sealed letter from General Lee to Joseph Reed arrived by express rider. With Reed still absent, Washington tore it open, thinking it might be news that Lee and his men were at last on the way. The letter was dated November 24th. "My dear Reed," it began, "I received your most obliging, flattering letter. Lament with you that fatal indecision of mind which in war is a much greater disqualification than stupidity or even want of personal courage. Accident may put a decisive blunder in the right, but eternal defeat and miscarriage must attend the men of the best parts if cursed with indecision. Lee went on to explain why he had not started for New Jersey as Washington wished, and apparently he did not intend to do so. What Washington thought or felt as he read the letter, or how many times he may have reread its first paragraph, no one knows. Clearly, Reed, his trusted confidant and supposed friend, and Lee, his second in command, had both lost faith in him. Washington resealed the letter and sent it off to Reed with a note of explanation. The enclosed was put into my hands by an express rider. Having no idea of its being a private letter, I opened it. This, as it is the truth, must be my excuse for seeing the contents of a letter which neither inclination or intention would have prompted me to. He thanked Reed for the trouble and fatigue of his journey to Burlington, and wished him success in his mission. And that was all. Possibly Washington was more hurt than angry. Later he would tell Reed, "I was hurt not because I thought my judgment wrong by the expressions contained in it, the letter, but because the same sentiments were not communicated immediately to myself." Possibly the charge of fatal indecision of mind also hurt deeply, because Washington knew it to be true. Above all, he must have felt profoundly alone as he had ever been. First Green had let him down, now Reed, and who was to say what Lee had in mind or might do? At Philadelphia, many of the Congress were ill or exhausted or absent. All three of the principal contributors to the Declaration of Independence were no longer present. Thomas Jefferson had gone home to Virginia in September. John Adams was at Braintree. Benjamin Franklin had departed on a mission to France. At times there were not enough delegates for a quorum, and as the news from New Jersey became more bleak and the British army drew nearer, Philadelphia was beset by an extreme outbreak of the jitters. The Pennsylvania Journal announced very good intelligence that the British intend to make a push for Philadelphia, and Richard Henry Lee of Virginia, among others, reported much alarm in the city and in Congress. Delegate William Hooper of North Carolina, another signer of the Declaration of Independence, described a prevailing torpor in Congress. Hooper, however, had no patience with those blaming Washington for every misfortune. "Oh, how I feel for Washington, that best of men," he wrote. "The difficulties which he has now to encounter are beyond the power of language to describe. But to be unfortunate is to be wrong, and there are men who are villains enough to brand him. There are some long faces here." Once during the siege of Boston, when almost nothing was going right, and General Schuyler had written from Albany to bemoan his troubles, Washington had replied that he understood, but that we must bear up against them and make the best of mankind as they are, since we cannot have them as we wish. It was such resolve and an acceptance of mankind and circumstances as they were, not as he wished them to be, that continued to carry Washington through. "I will not, however, despair," he now wrote to Governor William Livingston. On Sunday morning, December 1st, with British and Hessian columns advancing on Brunswick, 2,000 of Washington's troops, New Jersey and Maryland militia, their enlistments up, walked away from the war, and without apology. "Two brigades left us at Brunswick," wrote Nathaniel Greene, "notwithstanding the enemy are within 2 hours' march and coming on." Washington sent off still another urgent summons to Lee to come with all speed, or your arrival may be too late to answer any valuable purpose. "The enemy are fast advancing," he reported in a hurried dispatch to John Hancock, noting that the time was 1:30. "Some of them are in sight." He ordered the only bridge over the Raritan at Brunswick destroyed, and this had been largely accomplished. But the river was fordable, in some places only knee-deep. And as he also told Hancock, mincing no words, his present force was totally inadequate to stop the enemy. The first of the British artillery arrived at the river, and by late afternoon